All right, we're live.
Right on.
On air.
On air, this is live. No more dropping F-bombs.
Well, you can still do that. That's totally acceptable.
Cool. Okay, that just made my
Yeah.
day.
We have a mature audience. This is TVMA.
TVMA,
This is NC17. This is the
yeah.
NC17
Ooh.
nutrition webinar.
Oh yeah, I like it. Oh
Yeah, I see the door is closed in preparation. So that's,
yep.
I think we're good on that front.
The door is closed in the back, yeah.
Exactly. So we got Mike Castelli from Nova 3 Labs going to talk to us about undereating, overtraining, stress in athletes, all that kind of stuff. And Mike and I have known each other for a while. We first met, but it was still OPT back in the day, right?
Back in the day.
I think I first when I first met you was at an OPT nutrition seminar in Scottsdale many years ago. And I think that you're one of the first people in the CrossFit space, like really clarifying, like, hey, listen, like there's a difference between nutrition for performance and nutrition for health and longevity and nutrition for body composition. And that those are just not actually the same thing, right? That like at the very basic levels, like, yeah, there's stuff that pretty much everyone is going to need to do if they're just trying to get a little bit fitter, perform a little bit better, change their body composition. But once you get past kind of like that beginner stage or even that intermediate stage, that there's huge differences between what people should be doing if they want to potentially, beat people in a sport like CrossFit versus if they want to see, veins on their like their lower abs
Yeah,
versus what they
exactly.
should be doing if they want to, live to 95 and have a triglycerides level of 50 the entire time,
Yeah,
right? That those are just
totally.
like not even in the same ballpark potentially. So, the topic we have for today is the concept of overtraining and undereating in CrossFit athletes, which anyone who has coached people either in CrossFit or nutrition within this sport sees it all the time, where people come in and you're sort of like, okay, great, like what's going on? Like, let's talk about your training, let's talk about your food, all that kind of stuff. And you're like, you know what, like let's just see, just send me a few days of food just so we kind of know what's going on, we're on the same page. And you see someone who's doing double sessions, 5, 6 days a week. Let's say an athletic male, 5'8", 175 pounds, something like that, right? So like, not a huge person, but like relatively muscular, well muscled, right? Et cetera, like doing a ton of training. And it's like they're eating 2,200 calories per day, or at least allegedly are based upon their food logs. And you're like, whoa, like what is going on here? Like you should be eating probably, 1,500 more calories per day than you currently are. Like what in the world is actually happening here? So, that's a scenario that I think a lot of people have seen, or maybe some of the viewers themselves are experiencing something like that, where it's like, yeah, my nutrition coach told me that I need to eat more, et cetera. So, I mean, I think that just with that sort of basic scenario, like what is actually happening there? Why are these people doing so much training and eating so little food?
Yeah, you know what? That's really interesting. And I see this all the time within the community. And it's, my client base that comes in is predominantly performance based, and probably 90% of that of those clients I see under eating when I initially look at their food log. And it's interesting. I always think of there's two populations. There's the athletic population and then there's the sedentary. And what we see in the sedentary population are people who aren't moving enough and they're eating too much. And it's the exact opposite in the athletic population. People are moving a lot, maybe too much, and they're not eating enough. And you get different types of sickness or unwellness because of that. So when someone's overtraining, or let's say they're training and under eating, that is adding a relative stress to their body. And so I'm going to start really basic here. So training is a stress. Eating can potentially be a stress. Let's say under not getting enough sleep is a stress. And we all have a specific stress cup, right? Some people can handle a lot more than others, right? Some people can run on 4 hours of sleep and 1500 calories and train 12 times a week. And I'm being extreme on that, but they seem to excel no matter what, right? Other people who get 7 hours of sleep instead of eight and they undereat by just 100 calories, all of a sudden their life is destroyed, right? So everyone has a different level of stress resiliency. So to go back really basic, when we're training a lot and we're undereating, our body is seeking this fuel, right? It's like, okay, I don't have enough calories coming in. And it's looking at it like an extreme stress response. So it's a sympathetic response. So when we train, it's a fight or flight scenario. We have sympathetic nervous system activation. So that's analogous to running from the bear. And if anyone's ever listened to me talk, I use this analogy all the time. So I'm doing burpees, I'm doing muscle ups, I'm doing thrusters, and I'm like, wow, this is fun. Well, kind of. But your body looks at it like, wow, I'm running from the bear. This is a very stressful scenario. If we couple that with chronic under eating, when your body doesn't have enough fuel coming in, it's doubling the amount of stress on your body. So your body's like, look, I'm running from the bear like 6 days a week and I'm in a famine all the time. This is a really bad scenario. Initially, what happens? Your body will upregulate a hormone called cortisol. Cortisol is that fight or flight hormone, right? This does a lot of things, like it mobilizes glucose, causes your pupils to dilate, et cetera, et cetera. You know, epinephrine, releases epinephrine. Initially, in the beginning stages, people do actually really well, right? When this added new stress comes in. Human beings are really good in that short-term acute scenario of stress. It's how we adapt. Where we don't do well is chronic long-term stress. After a certain amount of time, people will end up, you know, this cortisol, it gets complex with here, and I don't want to get into the topic of, okay, does adrenal fatigue exist? Does HPA axis dysfunction exist? But after a certain amount of time, your level of hormonal or steroid hormonal resiliency is gone, right? Your body just has this disconnect where it does not want to respond to that stress response anymore. So things start happening, like your performance decreases, your recovery decreases. Even though you're in a caloric deficit, you aren't able to lean out anymore. Your body comes resistant to using fat as fuel. It's like, wow, I don't have enough calories. So whatever I take in, I'm going to keep, or I'm going to store as fat, right? So in a nutshell, that is that undereating, overtraining scenario, right? So I see this time and time again. Now, do you want to get into how we calculate how much an athlete should eat?
Yeah, I mean, I think that at least as a baseline, right, that like it's good to sort of have ballpark figures, right? Because like you mentioned, almost everyone who comes in a performance setting looking for potentially nutrition coaching, like you said, the vast majority of those people are probably under eating on a consistent basis relative to their activity level, right? They may actually end up sort of swinging the other way and like having these crazy binges because they have been under eating for, you know, 2 weeks at a time. And then they're just like, fuck it, I can't take it anymore. And, you know, then down 6,000 calories in a day. But you know, that ballpark understanding of like, okay, where even should we be, I think is super important for people because their calibration for it is just off a lot of the time.
Yeah, for sure. And, yeah. So what you mentioned there, that binge eating, you know, that can actually be harnessed and utilized, by a nutritionist or by an athlete, with the concept of a refeed. We'll maybe get into that later, but I want to talk about just sort of the basic calculations. Yeah. Where do we start? So, I personally use a couple different formulas to figure out an athlete's potential. And I say that in quotes, potential caloric needs. Everybody's different. Everybody responds differently. And there's always outliers, but one of the ones I use is a really simple formula. It's target body weight, intensity, training level or factor, and number of times per week training. A very simple formula, right? So as an example, let's say we have a 180-pound male and he trains in, let's say, some of his sessions are really intense and some of them aren't intense. So I might use a factor of 10. And I won't get into why that factor is 10 or 11 or 9, but I'll use a medium factor of 10. And then he trains 7 times a week, so he trained quite a bit. So that comes out to 3,000 calories, right? Or 3060 calories, exactly, 3060 calories. I like to compare that to the Harris-Benedict formula. And this is an older formula. It takes your age, your height, your weight, your gender. Comes up with a BMR. Now, BMR is basal metabolic rate. This is a really, really important number. Where I see major issues happen with athletes is when they're under-eating their BMR. So BMR, or resting metabolic rate, or basal metabolic rate, that's really the energy required to run the engine at idle. So if I'm sleeping at night, it's just my BMR, right? And so for that 180-pound male, depending on his age and his height and his weight, let's just take a guy who's like 5'10", 28 years old, he's gonna be around 1,900 calories for his BMR, right? If he's training 7 times a week, the Harris-Benedict factor, and that's 1.725, right? So that's coming out to 3,200 calories. So I know those formulas are pretty accurate in that regard. Theoretically, that's what he needs. I see athletes training multiple times per week under eating their BMR. And this is when we get into that you'll hear the term metabolic damage. There is no such thing as metabolic damage. It's metabolic adaptation, right? Your body's like, wow, I'm in a bad state. I'm going to turn the thermostat down. I'm going to reduce my basal metabolic rate. And that's when it becomes harder and harder to lean out. This has nothing even yet to do with performance. This is all about body comp. But I see, you know, people having a hard time leaning out. So it's really important not to undereat your BMR. But anyways, back on target. So we've got these two formulas, or we've got these two numbers. This doesn't really mean anything unless I've seen an athlete log their food for about 7 days. I need to see what their current level of intake is based on their hunger, based on their activity. So if I tell Johnny Rocket here to go eat 3,000 calories the next day, but he's only eating 2,300, probably a lot of bad things are going to happen. He's going to get frustrated. He's going to be overeating. He's going to probably feel super lethargic in the gym. He's going to be like, how can I eat this much? He's probably going to gain some weight, which is pretty common. So you have to sort of find a balance on that. But I think those two formulas plus logging your own food gives you a really good idea of where you should be. And 99 times out of 100, that number on those formulas is going to be bigger than probably what you're eating. If people out there calculate this and they're like, oh, cool, look at that. I'm eating 3,200 calories. And, you know, that's what, you know, the Harris Benedict says, you know, congratulations, you're actually eating and you actually fit into a formula. Everyone's different though. I've had 5'1", 125 pound female athletes eating 3,000 calories. I've had 6'4", 225 guys eating like 2,200 calories, right? Everyone's definitely different. And to throw a curveball in there, this doesn't apply at all to the male population, but female athletes with PCOS will have totally different numbers. Their carbohydrate tolerance will be completely different. They could be lean, have a lot of muscle mass, have a high degree of performance, but what they're able to tolerate for carbohydrate intake and total calorie intake is going to be a lot lower because of the insulin resistance associated with polycystic ovarian syndrome. So that's a topic in and of itself, right? So there are outliers, but that's sort of the basics of where I start for total caloric intake.
So can we just sort of summarize those again? I mean, so that you mentioned the Benedict Harris equation, yep. Which, you know, if you Google that, you can find a variety of online calculators where you can just plug your height and weight in. It gives you a basal metabolic rate. Then you multiply that by an activity factor, which will give you at least a ballpark of like a potential calorie number per day.
Totally. Yeah.
And then the other sort of like target body weight training sessions, can you summarize that again? And is there a name for that? That formula that people can potentially look up.
Yeah, no, there isn't a name for that formula. That formula is sort of based on, I think, you know, years and years ago, you'd see that, okay, if you want to lean out, you take your target body weight and you do and you times it by 10 or 12 calories and you come up with your total calories. If you want to maintain, you take your target body weight and you times it by 15. Or if you want to gain, take your target body weight and times it by 20. And that's really, it just comes down to a total calorie in there. But I've sort of added a training factor in there and number of times per week training, which is the demographic I work with. Mixed modal athletes are normally training anywhere from like 5 to 12 times a week. And it works quite well for that, right? So it'd just be target body weight times either 9, 10, 11 for men or 8, 9, 10 for women. Don't send me nasty emails saying, hey, I work just as hard as a dude. I know that. It's just women are different creatures, right? And your total number of weekly training sessions. So it seems to line up with Harris Benedict quite well. If you train less than 4 times a week, it's not accurate. If you train more than 12 times a week, you're a maniac and it's probably not going to be accurate. So, yeah.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's, again, helpful to just sort of have those two numbers that you can sort of utilize as, you know, a rough guideline of, okay, am I way off from these? Do these numbers give me, you know, at least a range that I can sort of try to sit in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the Harris Benedict is actually pretty accurate. What I found is it kind of overestimates a little bit, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's always higher than the other formula, but I think that's a good starting point, right, for people, especially so if we circle back to performance-based athletes, overeating or let's say consuming more calories than you're taking in. This is a dangerous statement to say, but it's generally a heck of a lot safer than undereating, right? And that's sort of the benefit of being a performance-based athlete is you're technically almost always going to be in a caloric deficit depending how you train, right? So that's a deep, dark rabbit hole to go down. But from a factor or from a perspective of salvaging your hormones in, let's say, a seasonal year, if you start under eating, okay, let's go back and say, okay, nothing's changed and the CrossFit Open is actually still at the end of February. If we consider that as a season, you know, you start under eating now, by the time the Open hits, you're going to be crushed, right? You're going to be in behind the eight ball. You know, your hormones are going to be depleted, so to speak. If you're overeating or eating appropriately, by the time the Open rolls around, you won't have taxed your endocrine system quite as much. And you would have been able to train at a higher level continuously for that season. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it gets into the complex issue of when you have a performance-based athlete who's like, hey, man, I need to lean out, but I need to maintain my performance. And then you're walking a fence, right? And that's legit too, right? You know, you have an athlete who maybe is not as lean as they should be. Can they get a performance benefit from being leaner? Yes. But the question that needs to be asked is, at what cost? And I've seen other well-known coaches and nutritionists, you know, give their opinions on this. And I think it's a very dangerous slope to walk on, right? I don't believe an athlete should be as lean as possible all the time. I think it's very individually dependent. There's a huge cost to getting lean. It's a major stressor on the body. The body doesn't like to have a six pack, right? It's like, whoa, I don't have enough energy. You know, what happens if I'm in a famine? Our DNA are millions of years old. They're not very smart. They still think feast or famine or fight or flight, right? So if you're always lean, and let's say you're not genetically predispositioned to be very lean, that comes at a cost, right? So there's always that cost of like body composition or performance. And unfortunately, with social media, all we see are the folks that have both, right? And that paints a picture that's not realistic for the other 99% of the population.
Yeah, so I think you started to touch on that trade-off between body composition and performance, which, like you mentioned, a lot of people have mixed goals, right? And that they may have a hard time being like truly honest with themselves because they're like, no, I just want to get as good as I can. And it's like, well, you say you want to get as good as you can because you like the way who people are at regionals look and you want to look like them. And you think that by getting to a higher performance level that you will look like them. Which, I mean, number one, like you mentioned, that just may not be possible for you on either level in terms of genetic potential. You just may not have the capacity to improve your performance to that level, and you may not have the capacity to consistently maintain that level of leanness without like severe behavior modification and caloric restriction. So, you know, it might not be in the cards for you. And then, you know, you say you're chasing performance, but you're really sort of like secretly chasing leanness, and then you just end up in this really weird, bad position. So, I mean, how do you explain to people the differences between performance, body composition, and longevity as far as goals? And how do you, I guess, like direct people in terms of what they should be eating on a, I guess, just like an intake level relative to those different goals?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And basically, everybody out there has mixed goals. It's very rare I'll see a client who is just strictly body comp or strictly performance. Even the games athletes will always have concerns about their body composition. It's human nature. We want to look good, right? So I think number one is getting that client to prioritize their number one goal. And I'll hit on that consistently in my consulting because that'll change over time. Some people are like, yeah, I'm performance. You know, summer's coming. I want to look good. So you need to really define that. Health and longevity. If we imagine three circles, there'd be performance, there'd be body composition, and there's health and longevity. And they all can go different directions. Sometimes they cross over, and for other people, they cross over quite a bit. There are people out there who they chase performance, they eat a lot of food, and they get great body composition. Lucky them, right? It sometimes happens. When a coach says, no, you just need to train harder and chase performance, and the body composition will come. And I see really good athletes say this, and I see well-meaning and knowledgeable coaches say this, but that is not true. That is not true across the board. So just sort of to rephrase that question again. So So what exactly are you asking
me? Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, since we're sort of talking about the concept of under eating and overtraining, mm-hmm. right, that like, I mean, sort of like you mentioned, people are kind of trying to bounce between these goals, and they may not have full clarity surrounding what they actually want. So, you know, if someone is saying they want performance, you know, what should their potential intake level be compared to someone who says that they want body composition and actually wants it compared to someone who says that they want, you know, health and longevity, you know, how are you actually adjusting the intake for these different goals? And then potentially also adjusting the amount of training that they're doing. Cause like you mentioned, each of these pieces is going to be an additional stress on that system to try to get the adaptation that we want.
Yeah. Okay. So really simply for performance, we definitely don't want that athlete being in a caloric deficit. Now, you know, people are going to go into caloric deficits at different times of the day, based on how much they've taken in, based on where their training is. But generally speaking, without looking at the minutia, generally speaking, a performance-based athlete doesn't want to be in a very severe caloric deficit or a caloric deficit. They want to be isocaloric, meaning their expenditure equates to what they have coming in. So they have the building blocks, the protein, fat, and carbs for recovery, right? That's really what we're looking at. We're looking at the ability to train hard and recover and do it again and again and again and again and again. And we can't do that if we're constantly running on less than a full tank, right? That's when we start to run into, hormone issues down the road, right? So simply speaking, performance-based athlete should not be in a very severe caloric deficit. You might have to have that athlete in a slight caloric deficit. And I'll use somebody as an example here. Travis Williams, excellent athlete, really, really good athlete. With him, it's a very fine line between how much he can eat and where his body comp sits. If he overeats, he will put on weight. That is his genetic predisposition. He will put on weight. If you talk to him, he's like, yeah, I'm a former frat kid, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we look at pictures from, like, you know, Throwback Thursday. And of course, you were like, whoa, check that out. But so he has the genetics to put on weight really easy. So he needs to be in that very tight range there, right? But if we switch to body composition, so what do we do? What do we need to do to get lean? Very simply, but this is more complex than I'm going to state, you need to be in a caloric deficit. You need to be expending more calories than you're taking in. But there's a big asterisk beside that, because that doesn't always work with people. Too much of a caloric deficit is too much of a stressor for the body. The body will be like, whoa, this is not cool. I'm not leaning out. Along with that, and this is not my department, but this is something I see a lot, is this style of training, right? And this is where I kind of beat my head against the wall a lot, where people are chasing body composition, but they're training for performance. Just like your nutrition goals need to be focused on whatever primary goal you have, your training has to be focused on the goal. Like, one of my favorite quotes is from Dan John, a strength and conditioning coach. And he's like, the goal is to keep the goal, right? People will start to do a lot of different things when they think they're chasing the primary goal, but it's not focused. I'm like, if your goal is body composition, everything you do should be related to that body composition, including your food quality, the type of training you do. If it's performance, exact same thing. It should be all geared for performance, right? Yes, people have mixed goals. And that's okay, but they need to understand that if you're seeking two different goals at once, the speed at which you're going to get to those goals is going to be halved. It only makes sense, right? It's like, yeah, over a long period of time, you can get better body composition. You can get better performance. But if you're putting all your eggs into the basket of one or the other, you will achieve that at a faster rate. So going back to body composition, you need to be in a caloric deficit. If you want to get into the topic of macro ratios and different types of macros, we can talk about that. Does that matter? For some people, yes. For some people, no. In my opinion, and I'm biased, I don't like to do extremes of, like, you know, hardcore paleo or low carb or keto or anything like that. I see that more problematic than beneficial. And there's been enough studies to show that there is zero metabolic advantage to a ketogenic diet. This could be a webinar in and of itself, right? And I put it into my nutrition seminar just recently because it's reared its ugly head again. You got lots of people doing keto and it's you know, messes them up. Anyways, I'm off. But if we talk about health and longevity, it's a little bit of a combination of both, right? But it'll be different. So your your eating style might be a lot different than it would be for leaning out. So if I want a client to lean out, and if they come to me and they're like, hey, I'm strictly body comp based, I'm like, cool, you're going to be high protein, fairly lowish controlled fat, and then carbs titrated to whatever activity you're doing, right? If I have somebody saying, dude, I'm 100% performance, I'm going to the games, I'm like, cool, you're going to have, you know, pretty medium to moderate protein. Fat would be in the range of what's needed to, and I'm being vague here purposely, because it's, I can't just throw out numbers. Fat's going to be needed to support hormone creation, and carbs, you're going to have a lot more carbs than you'd think. Because if you're performance based in a mixed modal sport, it's very glycolytic, right? You're going to be carbohydrate dependent. So your carbs are going to be really, really hot. If somebody says, and I don't have any clients like this, but I take an interest in it. If somebody says, dude, I want to live forever, I'm like, cool, we're going to take a really, really close look at your food quality. This can segue into food quality. Really close look at your food quality. See what kind of activity you do. You're probably going to be lowish carb, moderate fat, moderate protein, right? You're going to be, you know, if you look at the centenarian populations, that's basically where their nutrition lies, right? It's not super high fat. It's not super low fat. Everything's pretty balanced overall, right? But it's mostly lowish carb. If you're just sort of moving around at a slow pace, occasionally doing a sprint or two, low carb seems to have the benefits for longevity. Now, keep in mind, I didn't say low calorie. I said low carb. There's a big difference there, right? So I know that probably doesn't give the watchers or the listeners much to go on there, because it's all a little bit different. We can get more specific if you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, like you said, giving people sort of general prescriptions can be a little bit dangerous, since they don't always have the background to understand exactly what's going on. But I think the point that's more important is just that, like, there's slight variations in what we're actually trying to accomplish potentially with each of those goals.
Yeah.
Right? So the actual profile for nutrition for each of those pieces is going to be a little bit different, and that people should be aware of that. And that also requires a little bit more, I guess, like honesty surrounding what your goals actually are, which may take a while for people to kind of settle in and understand, like, okay, you know, maybe it's not realistic for me to go to regionals, especially if they don't exist anymore. you know, that there's changes there that people may just have to kind of like ease into and be like, all right, what am I actually trying to get from this? And, you know, is it important for me to be doing 10 Metcons per week if my goal actually is to look a certain way?
Yeah.
You know, and exactly. my intake may need to change based upon that.
Yeah.
So something else that I think that will happen to people kind of related to this is that, you know, they'll start doing something like CrossFit, although remember, like, okay, when I first started, you know, I started doing CrossFit, I started doing paleo. It was awesome. Like, I lost a ton of weight. You know, I got super fit. My lifts went up. My times went down. Like, it was the best time. So, okay, well, now I care more and I want to get better and I want to perform better. And then maybe I even want to lean out more, or, you know, potentially vice versa in terms of priorities. So what I need to do is more CrossFit and more paleo. So, you know, I guess, like, what are the potential ramifications of more CrossFit and more paleo for someone who's trying to take their performance or their body composition to the next level?
Yeah, this is something I went through and I experienced as well when paleo was in its heyday. And of course, it was like the next big thing, and it was the best thing ever, and it's going to change the world. And then years later, you start getting these people who are broken from paleo. And I was like, what's going on here? You know, if we take those two real specifics there, we talk about CrossFit, we talk about paleo. So CrossFit, insanely hard on the endocrine system, right? You're taxing all the energy systems. It's very, very glycolytic. It cranks your cortisol like nothing else. The probably only other two sports that would be close to it might be like MMA, might be like a decathlete or something like that, right? So it's extremely demanding, right? Then you got paleo. So what is paleo? So paleo is basically, by default, it's a lowish carb diet that is very nutrient dense, right? What happens when we do low carb or relative low carb and we're doing something like very demanding, like a sport like CrossFit? Well, all of a sudden our body doesn't have enough fuel. It doesn't have its primary fuel source, which is carbohydrates. So it's gonna do something called gluconeogenesis, the creation of glucose from non-carbohydrate sources. How we do that is through the upregulation of cortisol. It's one of the many things that cortisol does. Now, initially, human beings are always really good at responding to a new stress, right? So, and I've seen this analogy and heard this analogy time and time again. Oh, I started CrossFit. Things were awesome. They were awesome for 6 months. And then, oh, I totally blew up. Or, you know, I started doing paleo and, oh, I lost all this weight and I felt really good. And then things kind of stopped. And then, oh man, my sleep went out the window and I started to gain weight again. What's going on here? Right. Initially that's your hypothalamic pituitary axis telling your adrenals, dude, you need to pump out more cortisol, and all these good things happen. When we have cortisol, is not bad. When we have a lot of cortisol floating through our system, we feel really good. We're cognitively engaged. We can react faster. You know, it affects our basal metabolic rate initially, right? But over time, we don't respond to that stress as well. And then all of a sudden, it's not a matter of doing more paleo and more CrossFit. It's a matter of, okay, we need to change our fuel source, or we need to augment what kind of stressors we have coming in, because that high stress of the glycolytic style training of CrossFit is too much for your system at that point in time. Does that explain that, or was that a total mess?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that the concept of stress is essentially what we're getting at here, right? That,
it always comes back to stress.
Yeah. Yeah, that you know, if you start researching the actual physiology of what happens when organisms are stressed, that stress can have opposite effects depending on the severity of the stress and the duration of the stressor, right? So, like in some scenarios, stress actually, you know, improves immune function, totally. But then over time, it suppresses it. In some scenarios, to a certain level of severity, stress actually improves memory of like a specific event. But then past a certain level of severity, it actually makes people forget what happened, right? So that there's like these potentially confusing relationships between how much stress you're experiencing and how long the duration is, that make, in some scenarios, stress have one impact, and then in a different scenario where, you know, the pathway then hits a certain threshold or lasts past a certain time, it has literally the exact opposite impact. So it's very confusing for people to understand, like, okay, you're essentially trying to titrate the amount of stress that you're experiencing to get you the exact result that you want, right? Yeah, so something like training, it's like, okay, you know, a certain level of understanding how to push yourself and experiencing, you know, this higher intensity conditioning pieces and all that sort of stuff, that, you know, in the right dose response, that can actually be magical for people to get them results and to even understand a framework for how to push themselves. Mm-hmm. But past a certain point, it's like, okay, now you're doing this all the time and you're not recovering adequately from it. And now it's having the opposite effect of what you actually want. And that people saw the initial positive result. So they're like, oh, great. Like, this is the formula to get this outcome that I want. But then they don't understand that, okay, you can dial those knobs too high, right? You can say, all right, cool. I'm eating too few carbs. I'm doing too much glycolytic training. I'm not recovering enough. And now the stress has a totally different result on their adaptation because they've gone way past what they can actually recover from.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. And you just nailed it. Eloquently there, for sure. You know, and I don't like to use myself as an example, but I will in this case. So when I was training for performance for CrossFit, I was fit, but I also was getting really sick, like, you know, 3 to 4 times a year. Body composition was not bad, but not what it is today. How did I change that? I changed basically my stressor, and my major stressor was the style of training that I had. My nutrition was always on point, but that style of training made a huge difference. And I'm not saying people need to do like fasted cardio and bicep curls, but if we use that as an example, that is a lot less stressful than, let's say, I'm going to be extreme here, like doing like a triple Fran every day kind of thing. Like, people won't understand when I say that, right? It's a lot less stressful. So I can take that less stress that I'm getting from training, because I'm not being taxed very much, I can put that stress into my nutrition. What do we need if we're going to lean out? We need to be in a caloric deficit. So when I changed my style of training, and when I wanted to get lean, I could lower my caloric intake and feel good and not get sick and not compromise my immune system, right? So those are the two balances, the style of training. I'm glad we're focusing on that, because yeah, nutrition is the key. It's the one of the big keys, but it's also the stress of the training that matters too. So Cool.
Yeah. And so we spent a while sort of talking about varying goals and understanding, you know, how much you care about performance, how much you care about body composition, gave some people, you know, ballpark understanding of how to calculate intake relative to what they're doing and what their goals might be, without just sort of throwing some numbers out there, which can potentially be, you know, misinterpreted and misapplied. And I think one of the biggest things that, that happens with folks is they're like, cool, on the same page, totally get it. I'm definitely under eating relative to my training volume. I kind of have mixed goals. I want to get better, but you know, my main goal is essentially body composition. You're telling me to eat more. And I like, I totally understand what you're saying, but I'm going to get fat if I do that.
Yeah. And that's one that's tough on. So when I see that scenario, let's say I've got a client who is, they've been under eating, they've been overtraining. So the first thing I think, okay, person needs to eat more. How do we approach this? It can be really frustrating for the client, and it can be really stressful and frustrating for the coach. And it looks like it can potentially look like, I guess, a bell curve, right? A very gradual bell curve where we start to, or I start to, let's say I have somebody, I'll take some numbers. So let's say I have a 21-year-old female. She's been eating 1,700 calories based on her training. She needs to eat 2,400 calories. So right away, can't put that person at 2,400 calories the next day because bad things will happen mentally and physically. So we start to reverse diet her. And this is like, I wouldn't call it a term that's a flavor of the month. It's been around for a long time in the bodybuilding community. And I really like the way that the bodybuilding community works. They're one of the best self-experimenters out there, right? And the research is starting to catch up what they've been doing for years. So regarding this is how they would like, get somebody to come off a contest, let's say it's a figure contest or bodybuilding contest, whatever, and slowly increase their caloric intake so they don't put on a lot of fat mass. Same concept can be taken and implemented, let's say, in performance-based training, or someone who's training in a performance-based environment like CrossFit, but they're concerned about body comp. We need to reverse diet them. So you slowly start to increase their calories. What can happen though? Yeah, initially your body can put on weight, because it's sitting there in this fight or flight state where it's like, God, I'm going to famine every day. I'm running from the bear. And all of a sudden extra calories start coming in. Your body's like, whoa, this is totally awesome. I'm going to take this. And initially there might be a weight gain. Initially there might be no weight gain. Initially there might be a weight drop. Anything can happen. There's nothing set in stone. I don't know how a client's going to respond, but how they respond tells me how much metabolic adaptation they have. And if they're hormonally resilient, I've taken clients and started to feed them more than they were eating, and they've leaned out right away. That's always wonderful when that happens, right? It makes me look smart and it makes everybody happy, but it's really just the client's resiliency, right? If they have a really good hormone profile, their body's gonna be like, oh, cool, got food coming in. Okay, I can lose some of this fat. If that client has been under eating for a long time, initially they might put on some weight. And it's one of these things where you have to stay the course. And initially it'll go up and up, and everyone's getting nervous. Clients get nervous, coaches get nervous, and it levels off and it plateaus. And your body's like, cool, okay, I'm still training hard, but I've got food coming in every day. Yeah, we'll just hang out here for a while. And then we hang out there for a while. And then eventually weight drops and body composition starts to improve. Usually at the plateau, what'll happen is we'll get subjective body comp improvements where the client's like, dude, the scale still says, you know, 143, this is bullshit. But people are telling me I look really good lately. So those are the subjective things where the body composition or the recomposition starts to happen, but weight is staying the same, right? They might have adequate caloric intake now to start putting on lean body mass. That's not unusual, right? But then over time, their weight starts to drop. And then they're like, oh, now it's happening. And the question I get is, when does that happen? And my answer is, I don't know. For every client, it's different. It depends on that client. Everyone's a unique snowflake, right? You don't, just don't know how they're going to respond. So, but that is not uncommon to initially put on weight when you start to feed in a proper caloric manner.
Sure. And what should people expect? I mean, I guess as far as variation in their body composition or something like that, if they are body composition and weight as they start to potentially eat more or modify their training, right? I think that this is something that almost any coach struggles with is that clients will be super reactive to like, I PR'd my back squat. Like, this is awesome. And you're like, well, I mean, it was a 5 pound PR, which is well within like the normal variation of training. So like, good, I'm happy that you hit more than you've ever hit before, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything because we don't know like where your true max is. And you see the same thing with weight where it's like, you know, depending on when you last exercised, electrolyte content of your diet, you know, how much carbohydrate you've been eating recently, just straight up hydration status, et cetera. It's like, you know, you can move your weight up or down by 4 pounds without even doing anything extreme. Like, just like, oh yeah, I kind of like trained later than normal and drank a little less water than normal and sweat more than normal. And it's like, yeah, cool. You're down 4 pounds, but no, you're not. So, you know, that people will be quite reactive to the scale going up or down a little bit, or potentially, you know, looking at themselves in the mirror and seeing more or less definition, which a lot of these people have like borderline body dysmorphia anyway. So you kind of can't trust what they're saying, you know? So how do you, how do you communicate to them? Like, hey, like this is either good, we're in the right direction, or like, we can't make any judgments based upon your experience because it's within the normal error zone for what we're looking at anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that's a sort of a complex question there. I mean, if we circle back to what are we talking about here? I'll hit on something that's I'm sort of passionate about is the scale. So body weight, is this a valid measurement with clients? Should people be tracking it? Should coaches be tracking it? Lots of different opinions on it. My personal thought on it, I like tracking it in clients because it's a data point for me. It doesn't tell me what's going on underneath the hood, but, and this is a huge but, it can mess people up huge. And if you're not in a weight-based sport, if you're not a rower, if you're not a wrestler, if you're not a weightlifter, you should probably take that scale and throw it out the window. I've seen it mess people up more than anything. Because like you said, there can be so much variation, especially when you start to change your training, you change your diet. You know, even like a night of sleep deprivation can make your weight go up dramatically. I can fluctuate 12 pounds in one day, depending on what I've done or what I haven't done. Right. And that's not unusual for people in about the 200 pound range. You know, if you're at like the 120, 130, fluctuating 5 pounds within a day, that can totally happen too. So it's not a very reliable measure and it can cause more mental anguish than anything. I do like going off subjectively how a client looks, right, or what they see in the mirror. But like you stated, we see ourselves every day, so it can be really hard, and we are our own worst critics in that regard. What I'm getting my clients to do more of now, let's say even if they're performance-based and body comp-based, they have mixed goals, or if they just have body comp goals, I'm like, snap some selfies, do a side, do a front, do a back, keep it for yourself. You know, 4 weeks later, take a look, or show your spouse, or show a friend at the gym, right? When I'm consulting with my clients, and I'll ask, hey, how's body comp? Is it negative? Is it positive? Is it neutral? And they might be like, okay, I don't know, you know, it's changed. But, you know, so-and-so at the gym said, wow, I can't believe what's going on. Like, what are you doing? You look jacked. When somebody else says that, that speaks volumes, right? So I think that is more more appropriate than using a scale. I have clients who, it doesn't phase them. It's just one of the habits. They jump on the scale every day. They write it down and they have it recorded 365 days a year. For some people, it doesn't bother them, but more so than not, it definitely can cause some mental anguish, especially if somebody has the goal of leaning out. They associate leaning out with a lower number. And that's not always true. People have this idea of like, oh, back in college, I was 125 and I want to be 125 again. I'm like, yeah, but you've been lifting weights for like 5 years now. Right. So that, that 137 you're at, is maybe appropriate because you put on a lot of muscle mass. Right. So yeah, that's my thoughts on that. I see that day in and day out with my clients for sure.
Yeah. And it's always, again, it's always difficult to pull people out of the sort of like short-term reactiveness to how you feel today or what happened in the gym today or what the scale said today and get them to see that they're on a bigger picture trajectory. You know, may require them taking a step back from what they immediately think that they need, right? That they may need to train less and eat more to have a better chance of having the body composition that they want at a sustainable, you know, level over time. And that's hard for people to understand so that because they feel like they're taking steps backwards and maybe they are, but it's with the goal of taking a bigger step forward in the future.
Yeah. That whole concept of less is more. When it comes to volume of training, that's hard for a lot of athletes to wrap their mind around, right? that's a really tough one to get people to back that off. And then, you know, going back to changes, like when we radically change our diet, let's say your coach has told you, okay, instead of eating 150 grams of carbs, you need to eat 300 grams of carbs. You know, with that is going to cause some more glycogen to be stored. Every gram of glycogen comes 3 to 4 grams of water. So your body weight's going to go up. You might look really good eating more carbs because you're going to fill out your muscle bellies and you're going to feel good. It actually might pull water subcutaneously into your muscle, but all of a sudden your weight on the scale might go up 5 or 6 pounds, right? So, and you start training less, you're going to have less inflammation, you're going to have less water weight carrying around, right? So lots of different things can happen. So yeah, like I said, if I have any inkling that a client has any anxiety about body weight, I'm like, get off the scale. That's it. We're just not going to use it anymore. It's not going to dictate success or failure, that number. So,
yeah. And I think that, you know, the recommendations for folks who are potentially working with one of us, who are probably, you know, someone who's relatively good in their sport, right? Or who has already tried a bunch of stuff or is, you know, pretty far down the path of working on this stuff, right? That we're dealing with people who are not just the sort of standard person who needs to make some very simple lifestyle changes to get results as well. So that, you know, the population that's already tried a bunch of stuff and has already had a certain level of success and is looking to really dial it in, you know, the recommendations for them might be totally different than for someone who's just really trying to like, okay, I need to figure out what I'm doing. I have no conception of what's going on here, right, et cetera. Right. And that, you know, the folks who we're working with are probably already selected for being super high in personality traits like conscientiousness and neuroticism, which probably makes you good at CrossFit, but yep. You know, that there's potentially negative aspects to feeling like everything that you do is like a duty that must be executed. And that if you don't do it, a bunch of bad stuff is going to happen to you. That might be good in terms of like, okay, you get your shit done, but you know, there's a point where it's not actually helping you anymore.
Yeah. You know, and I think that what we were talking about earlier, prior to recording, we were talking about those kind of traits regarding nutrient density and processed foods, right? Yeah. And I mean, that's something I get a lot of questions on too. And people can take to an extreme is like, you know, so we've been talking a lot about the numbers, the macros, calories, but where does nutrient density fit into this with performance and with body composition? And that's not something that I track from a quantitative basis, but I mean, I'll take a look at a client's diet and really what I look for is predominantly whole food. And people are like, wow, that's too simple. You got to tell me what to eat. I'm like, well, you know, if you're eating like meat and vegetables, you know, whole foods, not processed, you know, nutrient density. That's really what I'm looking for. But I have clients who the easy fix on one of these would be somebody who's eating too much processed food, right? They need to eat more nutrient dense foods. Well, why? Because of vitamins and minerals. Why? Because those are the catalysts that make the protein, fat, and carbs do what they need to do, right? There's a plethora of studies out there showing improvement in nutrient density within diet causes health parameters to change positively, without a doubt. You cannot eat a high caloric diet, nutrient devoid, and expect your health to be maintained, right? Those are just as essential as protein. They're just as essential as fat, right? You have to have it, just as essential as air. You have a specific nutrient density, or sorry, nutrient deficiency, bad stuff's going to happen, right? But on the other hand, so you know, cleaning up your diet, not eating McDonald's, actually going to the grocery store, buying fruits and vegetables and meat and starch and stuff like that. That makes sense. That really resonates with people. They're like, yeah, okay, I know I need to do that. The other extreme would be someone, let's say a performance-based athlete who has a super quote-unquote clean diet. And I see this time and time again, where they are concentrating so much on the quality of food that they're actually missing the boat on how much food they need. Because there is sort of a checkpoint in where you can only eat so much whole food because of the fiber, because of the bulk and the volume of that food, they can't get in enough. And I have clients, I have to tell them specifically, hey, maybe you need to eat a big ass bowl of Cheerios with some almond milk at night to get that extra like 80 grams of carbs in. And for some athletes, that doesn't sit well. They're like, I don't know about processed food. I'm like, yes, if you are performance-based, you are going to have to get into the dirty carbs. If you're a female athlete eating over 300 grams of carbs a day, or let's say a male athlete eating over 500 grams of carbs a day, it's going to be really freaking hard to do that from rice and potatoes and oatmeal, right? Sometimes processed food is beneficial for athletes in the fact that they can digest it quicker It can hit their bloodstream quicker. It can go through their system quicker. Really what we're looking for is just the big numbers, right? But to spin all the way back to the start, does nutrient density matter? Absolutely. Can you figure out if you are nutrient deficient? You know, there's labs out there that have run some tests. I know you've run some pretty interesting labs from Genova, I think it was way back when, that can show some potential nutrient deficiencies. I don't think it's very accurate yet. I think the science is there, but some of the technology needs to catch up with that, right?
Have you seen Chris Masterjohn's testing nutritional status?
No,
PDF thing that he put out.
No, I'm familiar with Chris, but I haven't seen that PDF.
It's actually pretty cool. It kind of to your point, it's like, hey, there's all this stuff that you can test, and all these different tests are kind of looking at, you know, where this thing is potentially stored, or is this a metabolite of something, et cetera, et cetera. And he kind of gives a really detailed breakdown of like, hey, if you're concerned about being deficient in stuff, like here's some things that you can run. And he gives a breakdown of like, this one is actually really good, and if this is low, like you have a problem, versus like, you know, this doesn't actually tell you anything because you can't really measure how much of this is in your body. You can only measure how much is just sort of like in your plasma, and that doesn't tell you a whole lot. So like, you know, don't put a lot of stock in this. And I think that gives some pretty good insight into like, okay, you're trying to combine, you know, someone's symptoms or potential issues with some lab tests to figure out, all right, is this something, you know, and potentially dietary record, where like, oh, you have all the symptoms of potentially not having enough vitamin A, and you have some of these lab tests that indicate that your vitamin A may not be great, and we look at your food logs and you're getting basically no vitamin A. Well, maybe there's something here, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know what, and without a doubt, I've seen clients that have had micronutrient deficiencies, and it's usually pretty glaring when they do, but then you look at their food logs, you're like, oh wow, no kidding. But if I ever have a client who's concerned about that, and it's always cool when a client's like, hey, am I eating everything I should? When somebody asks that, generally they are. And really, without getting like, you know, you can dive into that and get sucked into that rabbit hole. But what I'm looking for clients that are eating a mixed variety of proteins, right? Mixed variety of animal-based proteins. From a nutrient density point of view, micronutrient density point of view, stuff like red meat, pork, fish, those are going to be higher in micronutrients than, let's say, a lot of fruits and vegetables. And this might blow people's minds, but way, way back when, this was in 2012, Matt Lalonde took some data to the Ancestral Health Symposium, and he basically crunched like 7,000 foods on his own, because the guy's insane and he's a genius. And he had a formula of specific micronutrient density based on 100 grams of weight, water removed. And what it did, it actually flipped the traditional food pyramid right on its head, where meat was the most nutrient dense, grains were the least nutrient dense at the bottom. So when I say to clients, yeah, you're going to get your biggest bang for your buck in micronutrients when we're talking animal-based protein, it's not because I'm a carnivore or I'm very biased to animal-based protein, but it's because it has the highest amount of nutrient density. So variety of proteins, right? Second one would be the vegetables, right? If somebody's eating protein at every meal, animal-based protein, and they've got vegetables at every meal, chances are you're hitting the spectrum. And the thing is to have a variety. Like, don't just eat kale. Yeah, kale's great, but there's way more to life than kale. You can pick I always say, rotate your vegetables. Get something that you don't know how to cook. Go buy an eggplant. Be like, what the hell am I going to do with this? Google it on the internet and be like, eggplant recipe. Oh shit, man, I could barbecue this, put a little olive oil on it, put a little cayenne pepper. Oh wow, it's amazing. So you've got something new in your diet, right? And I think after that, if I have a client who's doing that and they're like, hey, I don't know if I got my bases covered, should I take a multivitamin? I'm like, you know, instead of a multivitamin, I'd look at a whole foods green product, right? Something like Greens Plus or Daily Greens. Like, there's a plethora. Amazing Grasses is a good brand. There's a bazillion out there. To me, that's sort of a phytonutrient spectrum that you're hitting a bunch of different things that you wouldn't get in your diet. And it's sort of like covering your bases. It's insurance, right? It's not necessary, but it's insurance. So I'm being long-winded on the whole micronutrient thing. But
yeah, but I mean, I think that the idea there that we're sort of getting at is that, you know, there's a pendulum as far as like food quality, especially for someone whose primary goal is potentially performance. Mm-hmm. you know, body composition or longevity, like we talked about, that where you want to sit on that pendulum is going to differ depending on which goal you're really pushing, right? That we have the people who are super neurotic about their food quality and are afraid to eat a bowl of Cheerios. And it's like, yo, you need to get, you know, 4,000 calories per day. Like you got to figure it out. And then you have the other people, you know, who are following kind of a more like, oh, if it fits your macros, like I'm just going to eat, you know, the donuts that get me likes on Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. And then they end up actually having, you know, a very low, I guess, nutrient density in their diet, which is actually negative to them achieving whatever their goals are, whether that is performance or body composition. So, you know, you're just trying to sit people where they belong on that spectrum.
And, you know, so to talk about that spectrum, if I had to grade it in a level of importance, micronutrient density, longevity, number one, micronutrient density would be the most important there if we're looking at the long haul. Number two would be performance. In the short term, it may not be important or as important, and let's say as longevity, but over the long term, it will for sure, especially if we're talking about recovery and not just day-to-day recovery, but let's say month-to-month or season-to-season recovery, right? Over time, that's going to matter. And third, body composition. It probably matters the least. Your micronutrients probably have the least amount of effect on if your body is going to use fat as fuel. And it comes down to more of a caloric deficit for body composition, right? People can get lean eating donuts and Twinkies. It doesn't mean it's good, but you can, right? Your body's ability to use fat as fuel is not largely affected by micronutrients. Yes, there's enzymes that affect if you're going to use fat as fuel, right? But your micronutrient intake in the short term doesn't matter that much, right? Now that's not a green light for people to be like, oh, I can eat whatever I want because Mike said it doesn't matter. No, that's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying the priority on that would be longevity, performance, body composition.
Yeah, and with nutrient density, we're essentially looking at I guess like the concept of like triaging where micronutrients go in the body, right? That the body will preferentially shuttle, let's say, magnesium, which is involved in however many dozens of processes, to the most important ones for sort of like immediate survival if there's not enough, and then the ones that have more to do with like long-term reproductive health or like, you know, aspects of reducing aging, et cetera, that aren't quite as important, those just don't actually get enough magnesium. So there may not be like immediate consequences in terms of your body composition to you know, not having enough magnesium, because if you're just in a caloric deficit, like you're just going to start, you know, peeling off other stuff to create energy, and that's fine, but that you may have other consequences longer term that will impact things like your performance or your longevity, because you are potentially downregulating these pathways that relate to stress adaptation over time, or kind of like the maintenance aspects of you know, maintaining like cell health and all that sort of stuff, or that actually relate to reproductive health, like sex hormone levels and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And if you take a look at like the Okinawans or the Katavans, their nutrient density through the roof, right? And there's been a plethora of studies on both. And, you know, and their diets are relatively the same as far as their, let's say, their fat, protein, carb composition or ratios. But you take a look at their micronutrient density and it's like, there's zero. And traditionally, there was zero processed food in there. So everything they ate was nutrient dense, right? And these are people who lived regularly past 100, regularly without any signs of cardiovascular disease, cancer, cognitive impairment, right? And you can't say that about North American society these days, for sure, right? So yeah, nutrient density long-term, that's a long-term race, right? So yeah.
Right on. Cool. So let's kind of sum up everything we've talked about for people, since we've hit a few different areas. But I mean, the main topic of this webinar today had to do with the concepts of overtraining and undereating, right? Because we see this all the time in people who say they want to get better at CrossFit, right, to potentially compete, or who are kind of on this hybrid line between like, you know, I really want a six pack because I'm going to go to the beach a few times, and I also want to PR my back squat at the same time, right? So for these people, you know, that there's a lot of confusion surrounding what their priorities are and how much they should be eating, as well as potentially psychological barriers that they have for themselves relative to doing what they should be doing or what a coach potentially tells them to do. So, you know, just to kind of give a broad overview, like what are we actually recommending for people in terms of calculating their intake, thinking about, nutrient density in their diet relative to just kind of like getting enough food in, and then understanding the trade-offs between those different pieces?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to give a quick overview, I mean, for performance, we want to make sure simply we're eating enough. As far as the calculations, you can use the Harris Benedict, figure out where you stand in that regard, number of times per week training, you'll come up with a total caloric amount, right? And your total calories, what you're currently tracking with your food, should probably meet that for, if we're geared for performance. We don't want to be in a very large deficit or a deficit at all. If you're looking for body comp improvements, you're going to be using the same calculations, but then you're going to be titrating that to, you know, if you want to lean out, and I don't like throwing out numbers like this, but you do need to be in somewhat of a deficit. So let's just say it says you need to be at 3,000 calories. I'm so hesitant to do this because this will fuck people up. but you might feel good and have a little bit of hunger when you train and throughout the day if you're at like 2,500 calories. That's a 500 calorie deficit based on the Harris Benedict. So, I mean, that's a large number, but I'm just emphasizing you need to be in a deficit, right? But you also need to be able to train day in and day out. You don't want to be in so much of a deficit that you're going to be overtrained. But this is emphasizing body composition. If you're looking for health, longevity, do the numbers matter? Yeah, they probably matter. I'm more of a fan of like maybe if somebody had that goal, intuitive eating based on your hunger, prioritizing nutrient dense foods 24/7 throughout the day, right? Does that summarize it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, it really just helps people prioritize and understand, you know, what should be their priorities, depending on what they actually want from their training and their nutrition.
Right. Cool. Right.
And then just understanding that everything we're doing from a training and a nutrition perspective is actually stress on the system trying to get an adaptation, so that you need to be aware of like, okay, you know, under eating is going to be additional stress. And so my training may actually take a hit relative to that.
Yes. Right?
And adding additional training is going to be additional stress. So there's a line somewhere that past which I'm not actually adapting in a positive way, and I'm potentially getting the negative consequences of long-term stress on my system that can impact my ability to actually perform to the level that I want it to.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely a point of diminishing returns, and sometimes more is not more and less is more.
Exactly. Yep. So, Mike, thanks for helping us work through these problems. So you do nutrition coaching. You have some supplements that potentially help with some of these issues. You know, the folks on here probably know you, which is maybe why they signed up. But give us, just if people want to know more about what's going on, how do they learn more about Nova 3 Labs?
Yeah, so you can go to Nova3labs.com. And that's my company. I'm co-owned by that with Chrissy Barron. So we have nutritional and performance-based supplements that I've designed and that we sell. We also do nutritional coaching. We have some of our nutritionists also are programmers. Chrissy is also a mindset coach. She's in sports psychology, so she handles that. So we're branching into other aspects of coaching as well. But everything you want to find, whether you know you're looking for a specific coach or you're looking for a specific supplement, it's on the Nova 3 Labs website. I try to be as transparent as possible with the supplementation, and people know me for that. So if you're like curious as to what's in the supplement, I have everything listed, studies backing it up. I've always been particular about that. But
No proprietary blends.
That's right. Should almost trademark that logo. But yeah, so everything can be found on the Nova 3 Labs website.
There you go. Wonderful.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me, Todd. It was awesome.
For sure. Always a pleasure chatting.
Okay.
Great.
Cool. You know what I did like right at the beginning of